Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bernie Madoff is 71 years old, so the question was never really whether he'd spend the rest of his life in jail. It was the rest of his life plus how much. He was sentenced to 150 years this morning, which for some of his victims still isn't enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is good to have you with us on this Monday. Today is the 29th of June. All through the 6 months that Bernie Madoff's been a household name, it has been tough to pin down exactly how much his Ponzi scheme was worth. In court in New York today, the judge said a figure of $13 billion was conservative. Losses by Madoff's victims have been estimated at $60 billion. Prosecutors say when all is said and done, it's more like $170 billion, 170. There was, though, no such ambiguity in Madoff's sentence this morning, 150 years that the judge in the case said he hopes will send a strong message. For some of Madoff's victims who were in court today, it wasn't strong enough.
I got up, turned my back to him, and walked out on it. That's what I thought of it. 150 years? Why bother?
Tens of thousands of Madoff investors have been serving life sentences since last December. In essence, they don't even have money for room and board. They have to sell their homes, their possessions. It's very sad.
I think that 150 years was a very fair sentence. He should never, ever see the light of day.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think what I'm happy is that Madoff will be off the table. You know, it's been a foregone conclusion that he's going to get life. So this hasn't been like some kind of closure, like in a murder trial. Will justice be served? We knew justice would be served for him. His life is over.
Well, there's closure to his life, not closure to any of the victims' lives.
That was Marion Sigmund, Richard Friedman, Norma Hill, Jen Miro, and George Nirenberg outside the federal courthouse in Manhattan today. It is worth a mention that the case isn't over just because of the sentencing this morning. Investigators say they are still trying to figure out the extent of Madoff's fraud. Any day now, the Treasury Department is expected to announce the next phase of its plan to help banks unload those bad assets that are still on the books, toxic assets, you might have heard that phrase. More than 100 money managers have applied to run the program. Big names like PIMCO and BlackRock are said to be on the short list. But with things starting to look up for a lot of banks, some are starting to doubt the program will ever get off the ground and, in fact, whether we still need it at all. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports.
Here's how the public-private partnership was supposed to work. Money managers selected by the Treasury would raise cash from private investors. The government would match it and kick in cheap loans. Then the fund would buy troubled mortgage-backed securities from banks. Problem is, those banks don't want to sell. I asked Josh Rosner with advisory firm Graham Fisher why. He points at my wrist.
You've got a watch, and when you bought the watch, your watch was a $5,000 watch.
I wish, but anyway, let's say my watch is now worth half what I paid.
So if you were forced to sell it, you'd realize a $2,500 loss.
But if I just keep it on my wrist...
If you keep it on your wrist, then there's no loss to be had. So that's exactly the situation.
The banks are holding problem securities on their books, hoping they'll regain their value. Investors are willing to buy some of those assets, but only at a fraction of what the banks say they're worth. Sue Allen helps hedge funds and other investors value mortgage-backed securities. She says many were initially interested in the government's program, but they're starting to lose patience.
The people who funded these investment pools are saying, okay, well, if you can't find anything to buy, then we need to redeploy our money and put it elsewhere.
Then there's the question of whether the banks still need the program. Several banks have raised billions of dollars from investors in the last few months. That helps cushion losses from their toxic securities. It's kind of like me and my $5,000 timepiece. The more cash I have in the bank, the less likely I am to pawn that watch. But analyst Paul Miller with Friedman Billings Ramsey says banks still need a lot more capital, up to $1 trillion worth.
The bottom line is, is that we have not addressed the toxic assets on these balance sheets. And until we address them, we're going to still struggle in this environment and just jump from crisis to crisis.
Today, a Treasury Department spokesman said the public-private program is still on track. Miller says we still need some form of this plan, but one that's attractive to both investors and banks. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was much fanfare last month when President Obama signed a law to rein in credit card interest rates. No more surprise charges or outrageous rates, he said. But bank customers may notice the cost of using other kinds of plastic are going up. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports that banks have started tacking on new fees for customers using debit cards.
Debit card transactions withdraw money directly from your bank account. Unlike a credit card, debit card cash isn't borrowed from the bank. Debit card transactions now outnumber credit card usage, but Jean Ann Fox at the Consumer Federation of America says the penalties for debit card overdrafts are going up.
Just a few years ago, banks would not permit debit card purchases to go through if there wasn't sufficient money in your bank account, and now over 80% of banks let those transactions go through. So banks are encouraging overdrafts by letting people spend money they don't have so they can turn around and charge them their overdraft fees.
But Nessa Fettis at the American Bankers Association says debit card overdrafts have become a service for bank customers.
In most cases, consumers want the transaction paid. They've already eaten the dinner. They've already spent an hour doing the shopping. The cart's filled. Kids are crying. They want the transaction to go through, and they're willing to pay something for it.
Most banks charge $35 for overdrafts, and Bank of America just doubled the penalty if it's not paid within 5 days. Banks have also been raising fees for foreign currency transactions and for using another bank's ATM. Greg McBride at the personal finance website Bankrate.com says the new charges are designed to replace lost profits.
The tougher restrictions on credit cards that take effect in early 2010 do have the effect of putting credit card issuers and banks in a position where they're going to have to try to make up revenue in other areas.
The FDIC estimates banks earn nearly $17 billion a year from overdraft charges. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Rising oil prices helped energy companies on Wall Street today. Everybody else just followed along for the heck of it, I guess. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Royal Dutch Shell shut down some of its oil production in Nigeria today. Militants tried once again to destroy one of the company's pipelines in the Niger River Delta. It's a situation that energy companies in the notoriously unstable region are all too familiar with. Carol Ahoyos is the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times in London. Good to have you with us.
Hi.
Remind us, if you would, where Nigeria fits into the global oil markets.
Well, it produces more oil, or it can produce, in theory, more oil than any other African nation. It's very important for the U.S. It exports almost half of its oil to the U.S., and it's a member of OPEC, so it's a big and important oil supplier.
And the oil it has is the good stuff. It's the light sweet crude you can easily
refine,
yes?
Gosh, you're an oil nerd. Yes, that's right. It does. It produces the good, easy to refine, very valuable light sweet oil that U.S. refineries like to make into gasoline.
And once again today, we've had reports of rebel activity in the Niger Delta, mm-hmm. where there are a lot of oil platforms. This happens, it seems, every 2, 3, 4 days that there are rebel attacks, that platforms shut down, and there's a problem with Nigerian exports.
Nigeria is one of the most plagued countries in this regard. And in fact, I said that it can produce 2.7 million barrels a day, but in fact, it is only producing between 1.8 and 2.1 million barrels a day on a good day. And that just goes to show how much of an impact these attacks have had over the years.
If this were last year, though, with oil at $147, I bet the news would have been much more roughly taken by the markets. It seems now with lots of supply out there, it's not that big a deal.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in fact, there were attacks in the summer of last year when oil prices were $147 a barrel, and the market would move kind of $1, $2, $3 a barrel on news of oil being shut in Nigeria. Today's move was much smaller than that. I think we had a kind of 50 cent, something like that move. So it just shows how much sloppier the markets are right now and how much more comfortable we feel in terms of supply being able to come on in other places to substitute for the Nigerian crude.
Put it in the context, would you, of the American market. How important is it to the American oil industry?
Well, it's important, but no single country, other than perhaps Saudi Arabia, which just produces such a huge amount of crude oil, has that strong of an impact as long as there's other supply around. Just because you can just call up your broker and say, right, we can't get this Nigerian crude. Can you find it for me elsewhere? And at the moment, that's not too hard to do.
On the theory, though, that oil supplies will eventually get tight, any prospect of this unrest in the Niger Delta being resolved?
Well, I think the tighter things get, the more dangerous things get in Nigeria, the more of a voice the Nigerian rebels have. And, you know, Nigeria really is the cautionary tale. You have dire consequences when you have a very, very, very poor country producing a lot of oil and a lot of wealth, and that wealth is mismanaged.
Have there been any indications from Western oil companies, either European or American, that they're going to stop trying to produce out of Nigeria?
No, I think we got close to trying to find that out. Well, we did try to find that out last year, and they do seem to be in a complete catch-22 there. But at the moment, I've never heard anyone say that will stop. The companies most affected are Shell, Chevron, Exxon, Total, and Eni. None of those have said they'll stop.
Carol Ohoyas is the chief energy correspondent for the FT in London. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The 4th of July is a big deal everywhere, of course, but somehow it's, I don't know, bigger in Boston, where the Boston Pops play patriotic medleys along the Charles River. There's fireworks and everything. The thing is televised nationally. Corporate sponsors the whole bit. This weekend, though, a lot more people might be watching those big city fireworks on television than actually seeing them in person. Towns across the country are canceling July 4th celebrations to save on the hefty price tag. But in one city not far from Boston, local businesses have chipped in, as Kurt Nickisch reports now from WBUR.
Lowell, Massachusetts is less than 30 miles from Boston, and it used to be a wealthy town, something you can see in the grand city hall built during fat times as a textile manufacturing center. But times got pretty thin, and this latest recession has slammed Lowell with foreclosures and layoffs, bringing down the tax base.
Because of the budget constraints, we could not fund the fireworks this year.
Mayor Bud Caulfield couldn't justify the $45,000 price tag.
We have laid off 48 employees. Had we had the fireworks, we would have had to lay off 49 employees. And it just morally wouldn't be right to do that.
But it also didn't seem right not to celebrate America's birthday, at least to Rich Bolton, who runs the Lowell Cooperative Bank. Bolton doesn't blame the mayor. In fact, his bank's bottom line is not where he wants it to be either. Some local construction companies went out of business recently and defaulted on their loans.
The $45,000, I wish I was a big enough bank that I could write the whole check and just make it happen, because that's the way I felt at the time.
Bolton knew that this city, with so many people out of work, was going to miss the fireworks event. The bank's loan officer, Ziggy Burns, says many of his clients can't afford even a modest vacation. The 4th of July celebration is their time to let loose a little.
A lot of people in the city, that's their summer.
So Bolton, the bank CEO, did some quick math. The number of banks around town, the number of big businesses, and he made out a check for $5,000 and gave it to the mayor.
I said, hopefully that's enough money to get things going. We're the smallest bank in town, okay? Everybody else should give more. And I said, that should get you there.
It did.
When I heard it was on, it was extremely exciting.
Lowell resident Nancy Crocker says people here need the 4th of July celebration.
I would think that it would remind them of what they've got versus what they haven't got, even in this economy.
So this weekend, down at the pavilion by the river, there's going to be hot dogs and popcorn for sale. The Lowell High School Band is going to play a mix of Broadway tunes and patriotic numbers. And the city's going to burn through $45,000 worth of fireworks in about 45 minutes. A blazing reminder to residents who need a better economic outlook that they still live in the land of opportunity. In Lowell, Massachusetts, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, debt isn't all bad.
That's not hedonism, or at least it doesn't look like hedonism to me. That looks like a form of economic discipline.
If you pay your bills. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks jumped today on news of rising oil prices and maybe a hefty sentence for Bernie Madoff. The Dow Industrials powered up 1%, 90 points, closed at 8,529. The NASDAQ pushed up a third of 1%, 5 points, finished at 1844. The S&P 500 jumped 9-tenths of 1%, 8 points, 927. It hit the bell there. Energy companies led the gainers as oil spouted above $71 a barrel. Exxon gushed up more than 2% today. Chevron rose 1.4%. Valero Energy jumped 9-tenths%. Ford Motor drove up 3%. Microsoft rose 2% on a favorable report on its new software package. Best Buy gained 1% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society. FFYF.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Do you feel like spending money? Do I? The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. In Los Angeles, a private funeral service is planned for actress Farrah Fawcett. And teachers attend the National Educational Computing Conference, continuing in Washington. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you wanted to bookend the age of excess on Wall Street that it seems we have just seen the end of, you could do worse than looking at the writings of Michael Lewis. 25 years ago, his first book, Liar's Poker, gave us an inside account of life in a big trading firm on Wall Street. He has been writing about Wall Street and many other things, of course, ever since. He's got a new book coming out this fall about the crisis we're still in the middle of. And when we talked, I asked him whether he thinks Wall Street understands, even now, what it's done.
They all realize that for the first time in their careers, their firms were accused not just of being greedy, but of being stupid. But it was so clearly in your interest, even if you saw that it was a disaster in the making, to just go with the flow. Because so long as the market continued to rise, the firms made huge sums of money, you got paid huge sums of money, and even if you had tried as an individual to stand up and say, I think we shouldn't be doing this. The minute you were proved right, your firm was doomed and you wouldn't get paid. There was no incentive to behave well.
If we want to point fingers, which a lot of people still really do, because part of this is it was you did this, where do you go?
There are people you could lynch and feel good about it, but the problem isn't the bad people. The problem are the rules of the game. I think if you want to kind of trace it back to ground zero, There are a series of attitudes at the bottom of the crisis. A belief that whatever markets did was basically useful and good. Mm-hmm. And if you gum them up, you were going to destroy this wealth-creating machine. Now people don't swallow the argument that Wall Street knows what it's doing. People are, if anything, more skeptical than they should be about Wall Street. So that's why I think it's come to an end. That belief, the faith in Wall Street, has collapsed.
When you sit down and think about it, and we try to reflect on the past 2 years of craziness that we've had in this economy, what don't we know yet about what happened on Wall Street?
We don't know the extent of the losses inside the institutions. There have been phony stress tests where Citigroup could call up the Treasury and tell them exactly what their assets were worth. There's been no independent evaluation of them, although we do know. You know, the IMF has been very good about publishing what they suspect are the losses, and they don't square with what the Treasury claims are the losses.
This is the International Monetary Fund telling the U.S. Treasury what
it thinks. There's a gap of, you know, $1 trillion or something. So we don't know how bad things are actually inside the financial institutions. We don't know just generally, we don't know why the people made the decisions they made at the time. We don't know exactly what they were thinking. What was the person at AIG thinking when he essentially underwrote the entire subprime mortgage market in 2004 and 2005?
With all those credit default swaps.
Right. They essentially took all the risk for a year and a half. So there's been, to me, a shocking lack of curiosity in institutional America about what actually happened. And I know this because when I go out to interview people, say at AIGFP, people who actually know what happened, I'm the first person they talk to. Nobody from the Treasury had showed up. Nobody from the New York State insurance regulator had showed up. They had not been properly debriefed. And that's just amazing.
So are you scared for what might yet happen?
I think that we're in for a greater reckoning down the road. I think that this crisis is not over. I do think that the stimulative policies that the government has adopted in response to the crisis will mute some of the worst effects. But I do think that there's some shocks to specific Wall Street firms that still have to happen. And that doesn't really frighten me. I think those are opportunities. I think there needs to be another moment of fear to generate the kind of reform that would be lasting and useful.
Michael Lewis, you know him from Liar's Poker earliest on and then a bunch of magazine articles and books. He's got a new one out, too. It's called Home Game, about fatherhood. Michael, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
For 2 years and more now, the main thing we have heard about debt is that it's bad, how too much of it and the wrong kind of it helped send the economy way off the rails. But there are good things to be said about being in hock. Stephen Smith of American Radio Works reminds us that owing money used to be, and still can be, a ticket to the middle class.
Our story begins in 1945.
We have another bulletin here. Japan surrenders. Japan surrenders. Now repeating the entire bulletin.
When World War II ended, millions of American servicemen and women returned home. But home was hard to find. After a long war, GIs came back to an acute housing shortage.
We've had a time with housing while you were gone. Building materials and labor went to war.
This government film explained the housing shortage to returning veterans, many of whom had to share crowded quarters with friends and parents and in-laws.
Dottie's folks are swell, but a fellow would like to spend a little time alone with his wife after 3.5 years of community living in barracks and foxholes.
To help the returning vets, President Franklin D. Roosevelt created the GI Bill of Rights. The GI Bill offered a sweeping program of benefits, including government-backed home loans. At the time, most Americans were renters, especially people in their 20s, like veterans.
Owning their own home at that time in their life when they were just getting started in their careers was unheard of.
Author Ed Humes wrote a book about how the GI Bill transformed America. He says that before the government got involved, home loans were something only the better off could afford.
Before the war, a typical mortgage was 50% down and a relatively short repayment period. But the financial guarantees and funding of the GI Bill made it possible to offer these then very novel working class mortgages. 30-year mortgages became the standard because of the GI Bill.
If you think about it, Roosevelt may have been the most influential mortgage broker of the 20th century. FDR made it possible for millions of Americans to buy a home and to start building up equity. The GI Bill introduced a whole generation to the potential benefits of long-term debt. When Jerry Ulrich returned to Minnesota from the U.S. Navy, he and his wife Gertrude first tried to get a home loan from their local bank.
They told us right straight out, no way.
Gertrude Ulrich says her husband was the son of a fireman, and the couple had little money. They wanted to buy a house in the budding Minneapolis suburb of Richfield.
The credit and loan said, much as we'd like to see you establish yourself in Richfield and move to Richfield and start a family and all those kinds of things, no, we can't because you don't have any credit rating. We have nothing to go by. So that's why they suggested the GI Bill.
In fact, the federal government not only backed the Ulrich's mortgage, the GI Bill paid for Jerry's dental school. It also provided a low-interest business loan so Jerry could set up a practice. With millions of young World War II vets eligible for mortgages in the 1940s and 50s, there was an explosion of home building. Author Ed Humes.
The GI Bill led to the creation of modern American suburbia.
Suburbia meant shopping malls, interstate highways, and the baby boom. With more credit available, Americans bought more consumer goods like cars, refrigerators, and televisions. The post-war years marked the high point of American prosperity. Today, as the so-called greatest generation passes on, historian Lendell Calder says it will hand down a vast amount of middle-class wealth.
Late baby boomers like myself stand to inherit more than any previous generation in American history.
Even with the current recession, economists say that figure is some $40 trillion or more. Lendell Calder says we have debt to thank, at least in part. Sure, Calder says, credit cards and home equity loans made it easy for some people to live beyond their means. But debt also encouraged something else.
You sign your name on a piece of paper, which gives you delivery on something you really, really wanted. But then follows weeks and months and sometimes years of hard work to pay back on those bills. That's not hedonism, or at least it doesn't look like hedonism to me. That looks like a form of economic discipline.
Back in Richfield, Minnesota, Gertrude Ulrich and her husband paid their bills on schedule, raised six children, and sent them all to college. She says it's all because the government made it possible for a young sailor and his wife to borrow some money and to work their way into the middle class. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note for the numismatists among you. Britain's Royal Mint fessed up to a wee bit of an oversight today. Apparently late last year, it stamped out 100,000 or so 20 pence coins without a date on them. Coin collectors love mistakes like that, not least because when they eventually hit the market, those coins are worth a whole bunch more than their face value, in this case about 33 cents American. Although, to be fair, the Mint does have a pretty good record. Last time it left a date off a coin was 1672, if you keep in track or something. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 90 points, 1%. The NASDAQ added 5 points, also 1%. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points, 0.9% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, baby boomers and Generation Y find common ground in the workplace.
The boomers, they're into the other side of their careers, and they do want a more generous take on what work can mean, and they're certainly now seeking that meaning and purpose.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.